So let me start again. So let's see. This is a so this type about type functions is also connected with classes, as you'll see. But I'm conscious that luxury levels are going to get too low in a little while. So what you're going to show is I just need to have a time frame that we're all working on the same expectations. Like 40 minutes is what you want, or 30 minutes, or an hour. What are you? You tell me it will fit. An hour. Okay. All right. Just so if you start wandering, feel free to wander away. Right? I feel like you're all trapped here. This path. Right. So, I gave this talk. Tony Hall is a member of my lab. As in the inventor of Quicksort, he's two offices down. It's quite a privilege to work with him. He had the 75th birthday celebration, so this was a talk I gave for that. And here is what. Tony says about program correctness. There's a basic idea of computer science. The most widely used tools in pursuit of correctness concentrate on the detection of programming errors, widely known as bugs. Foremost among these tools are modern compilers for strongly typed languages. And here he is dissing my compiler, pretty much. Like insects that carry disease, the least efficient way of eradicating program bugs is by squashing them one by one. The only sure safeguard against attack is to pursue the idea of not making errors in the first place. I can hardly disagree with that. So, but I think he's being a bit cruel here, right? Because he seems to be implying that static typing is really not much good, right? But actually, I think static typing is fantastic, because it doesn't squash bugs one by one. It squashes whole species of bugs. You know, no more cockroaches, ever. That's really good. And if you think about a type as a specification, it's kind of like a partial specification. So this function, this type for reverse, tells us something about reverse. It takes a list to a list, but not too much. It doesn't tell us exactly what it does. Because telling us exactly what it does is too bulky and voluminous. Types let you say something. They let you move on this spectrum, right, of an increasingly precise specification, no specification, up to complete specification. And if you prove that the program meets the specification, whatever it is, the more precise the specification, the more confident you are that your program is going to work. And so types live at the left-hand end of the spectrum, but they really do work extremely well. If you think about formal methods, types are the world's most widely used formal method by 6 orders of magnitude, right? Everybody in this room is writing type programs all the time, I guess, unless you're writing C# or .NET programs anyway. So, why is static typing so widely used? Well, it's light enough weight for ordinary programmers to use, people like me and you. It's machine checked by the compiler every time you compile, not a sort of special human guided process. And it's kind of ubiquitous. Every value in your program has a type and must have a type, and the compiler enforces that. So, this combination means that you can't get away from the types, but they're sufficiently lightweight that, on the whole, we put up with them. In fact, I think we do more than put up with them. I love them to death because they, by the time my program gets past the type checker, it usually works. So there is a kind of spectrum here. At one end is no typing at all. Another end is sort of simple specifications like types. Right at this end is a full-on theorem mover like clock or 12 or something, in which you write a full program specification and using human-guided but machine-supported automated theorem proving. You prove the program correct, but this is kind of like a tactical nuclear weapon, right? It reduces enormous fortresses to dust, but with great collateral damage, and it needs an expert to run, and really a very highly trained user to write a cock specification and execute. So there's some cock guys fitting in. Yeah, right. So you guys, you're the tactical nuclear weapon operators, right? But I'm a sort of hammer and chisel guy, right? Simple tools. My goal is to take, if you like, we can take just types like int arrow int, and then we get slightly more interesting types like for all a arrow a. That gives us a richer type system to express some more properties. And the type classes let you go a bit further, and I want to get you go a bit further still. And the subtyping stuff we saw is a bit divergent, different ways. It's not a linear spectrum. And I want to show you one extra piece today. And so our goal here. Today is to retain all the good properties of types, you know, lightweight, ubiquitous, checked all the time, and so forth, while making more good programs past the type checker, that is, it's annoying if the type checker rejects a program that's perfectly okay when you run it, but isn't typed incorrect, right? That's really irritating, because the type system is getting in your way. But we'd also like to make fewer bad programs pass the type checker, because, well, the type checker is supposed to be rejecting the bad programs. So, here's the picture. Here are all programs. These are the programs that work, the green ones. The programs that are well typed are the sort of red circle, and we'd like to make this overlap region bigger. And we'll see this example coming up in a bit. Okay, I'm going to show you just one example of how to do that. Now, here for a reminder is our type class declaration for none. Now, suppose we wanted to generalize it somehow, so that rather than num taking two arguments, both of type A and returning a value of the very same type, we'd like to write a class gnum, which plus took a value of type A and a value perhaps of a different type B, so gnum is a two-parameter type class, and returns a result of, well, I'm not quite sure yet, something to do with A and B, maybe A, maybe B, maybe some combination. So we'd like to say things like, if A is an int and B is int, then we've got gnum int int, and we could use plus int, in which case the question mark here would be int. If we add an int to a float, well, how we add an int to a float? Well, perhaps we convert the int x, that's the first argument, to a float, and then use plus float, right? Now we get a float result. So we're kind of hoping that we could then write plus on two ints here, or we could also write the same plus, this plus in fact, on an int and a float. Are you with me? Modulo the question marks. So what's the problem with the question marks? Well, the trouble is that the type we want here is kind of dependent on the two input types, right? If you tell me the two input types, I can tell you the output type, right? So we'd like to express some kind of box which you feed in input types and it spits out an output type. So if you feed it into the float, you might say output type float. Float and float, output type float, or something, right? Maybe float and float, output type double, who knows? It's just a box that takes two inputs and produces an output. So it's a function. Right, so in fact it's a function on types. So the natural thing to do is to do type-level functional programming. You'd like to say, it takes the gnum here, goes from A to B to, well, some tie, AB, where some tie is a type-level function. Right? And how do we say that? Well, here's how we might say it. In the class declaration, we say, as well as this value type signature, I supply the type function kind signature, right? That says some type takes two inputs, A and B, both of which are types, and produces a result which is a type. This star is just pronounced type in Haskell. That's the kind system. Okay? So all that we're doing here at the moment is generalizing the class declaration so we can declare not only new value-level functions, but new type-level functions, and in the types of the value-level functions, we use the type-level functions. At least at an intuitive level. Do you get the kind of picture that we're trying to say here? Now, it's kind of, the next bit is kind of inevitable. When we give an instance for gnum, int int, as well as giving the witness for plus, that says, here's an implementation of plus, on two ints, I also want to give an implementation of some tie on two ints. So the some tie function, when fed with int and int, returns, well, I've chosen int here. I could put any type I like, it's just up to me. But when I write this instance declaration, I'm giving an implementation for some tie, just as I'm giving an implementation for plus. And if I add an int to a float, then, this implementation here, for plus, took the int x, converted it to a float, and added it to y with plus float. So presumably the result is a type float. So some type in float is float. Okay. So we can call it, so some type is just an associated type of the class. The terminology. Does that make sense? And it kind of has a kind of natural feel because we generalize the class by, as well as giving value signatures, we give type signatures for values, we give kind signatures for types. And in the
instance declarations, as well as giving a value definition for the values, plus we give a type definition for the type things. So it's kind of, there's a nice fibonacci and duality. Okay. So now, of course, the type checker has to play this game now, because when it's doing type inference, it's going to say, it's going to say, plus float of int to float x, this whole right-hand side, the type inference engine looks at it and says, that's got type float. What type am I expecting it to have? Some tie in float. So it's got to say, is float equal to some tie in float? So it has to do a bit of sort of compile time reduction in the type system to say some tie in float is float. So it's got to do that during type inference.
Okay?
But it doesn't have to do that, as it were. The many occasions in which these type functions appear, where they're not just macros, they're not macros that, as it were, can be worked out on the fly completely. So if I have a data type declaration here, data type TAB is mukti, there's the constructor, there's got an A and a B, and a sumtie AB. Well, I can't reduce this at all. I don't know anything about A and B. So sumtie, T1, T2, for two types, T1 and T2, is a perfectly good type. I don't have to always be able to sort of rewrite it and rewrite it until it goes away. Here it's not at all rewritable. You should just think of it as a type level function which is sort of stuck in here. Now, we talked about making bad programs not work. So, if I had a bad program, I might want to say, I don't want to add dollars to integers. How do I prevent you adding dollars to integers? Well, I can prevent you doing that just by not having an instance for gnum dollars and integers. Here's a gnum dollars dollars. I want to add dollars to dollars, but I don't want to be able to add dollars to anything else. So I simply omit instance declarations for dollars and int. I just say the things that I want. I should explain here this thing that says new type dollars. If this said data type dollars, data dollars equals, there's the constructor mukd of int, that just says a value of type dollars is a mukd constructor applied to integers. So that, if it, a data type, that implies that there's a sort of heap allocated box. By replacing data with new type, I just mean that dollars and int are two isomorphic types. They're represented identically, there's no overhead from new type. But nevertheless, mukd is a thing that takes you from an int, that coercion from an int to dollars. And this pattern matching gets you from dollars back to int. So here, I pattern match on mukd here to get back from a dollars value to an int value, and then add the int values and coerce it back into dollars with mukd. That's all that's going on there.
Okay.
So that's all numeric stuff. I want to show you now a use of the very same idea, this type level function stuff, to design a completely different kind of data structure it's a type indexed try. So imagine that you're implementing a finite map from keys to values. So, and the keys are going to have various types, and the values are going to have any other type. And the idea is that we want the data representation of the map. So the map is going to be a data structure. It's just like imagine a balanced tree or something. And the mapping is going, if the keys were Booleans, how would you represent a finite mapping from Booleans to values? If that was your specification. So what do I mean by finite mapping? I mean, if I say, look up true, and you're meant to say, it's in the map, and its value is 6, or maybe it's not in the map. And if I say, look up false, you can say, it's there or it's not there. If you say it's there, you've got to give the value back. So there's a lookup operation with type, map from key to value to key to maybe value, or option value. Now, for Boolean, I just want to store the two values. Right? If I've got, they're just two keys, I might as well just store the two values if they're there, right? One or the other. If the key was an int, I might use the balanced tree. But if the key was a pair, one kind of neat way to represent these kind of finite maps is to represent a map with whose key is a pair as a map from x's to a map from y's to the final values. Does that make sense? Sort of stacked map. So rather than having, as it were, a balanced tree whose keys are pairs, you have a balanced tree whose keys are the first component. And when you find your way to a leaf, you find a balanced tree whose keys are the second component. Does that make sense? You're looking a bit glazed. Smile or something. Did that make sense? Because this idea of a sort of nested tri is kind of, it's good. Got it, okay? All right. Now, with Haskell before type functions, we just couldn't describe this data structure. But now we can. And here's how. So we're going to make a class key. So this is going to be the class of keys. And it's going to have operations lookup, which takes a key and a map from keys to values and produce a maybe value. What's this maybe type? The data type maybe is either nothing or just A. So this is like, if it, this is like a nullable value, right? A value type maybe A is either nothing, like null, or just A, meaning, well, it is a pointer. So in most O-O languages, every value is a maybe value because they're all potentially null. Right? So this maybe type is a way of saying the value is either there or it isn't. Okay? So the lookup, see why, the lookup has this type? It says lookup this key in this map and return either nothing, meaning the key is not in the map, or just V, meaning it is in the map. And here's what's right. Okay? Does the signature make sense? Just ignore just think of these two first. Or maybe just look up. Look up, okay? Now, by putting map as an associated type of this class, I'm saying, oh, this map is its data representation may vary depending on the type of keys. And that was exactly what we wanted to say here, right? So the data representation of map may vary with the keys. It's easier when we see the instance declarations. So here's the instance for bool. So a mapping for booleans, how do we want to represent a map with a boolean key? Well, so here's an ordinary data type declaration, except that it's got this bool thing because it's the same as this. We're instantiating this class of bool, so we've got to instantiate this parameter exactly the same way with bool. And it's built, so it's just a pair. NB is the data constructor for this data type declaration. So it's a pair of a maybe V and a maybe V. This is the optional value for true, and this is the optional value for false. So NT is a map. So it's an MB with two nothings in it, right? Because it's an empty map. Neither, it's completely unpopulated. If we look up true, well, we just pick out this guy, because this guy was the true value, right? We return him, that's the right type. And similarly for false. So that was really easy. The fun bit comes for pairs. So if we want AB pairs to be a key type, well then, like I said, our maps are going to be implemented as MP, here's the constructor, and a map from values of type A to a map of values of type B to V. Right, so that's that stacked map game that I was describing. And to do a lookup of a KA-KB pair in such a map, one of these MP things, what have I got to do? I look up KA. Well, this M thing is a map on values of type A. So I look up the A key in the map, and either it says, I'm not there, right? There are no values in this map which have A, this KA, as the first value, in which case we return nothing. Or it says, there's at least one that has an A value there, in which case it returns the map, a map BV. So M2 here is a map BV. We just look up KB in that M2. That's kind of fairly simple and beautiful code. And it's nice that the representation of the map simply adjusts to the type of the value. So we say that the map is indexed by this type K. Indexed meaning the actual representation of maps varies depending on the type K. We're not used to that. If you say list of int and list of bool, the representation of the list is unchanged, right? They're either ints in those empty slots or bools in the elements of the list, but the representation of the list still looks like a string of consonants. But if we say a map from pairs of bools, say, to some values, well, the representation of that map varies with the index type, the key type. And that's so this is a you might wonder here whether you could play this this instance works on pairs, but it turns out this works equally well with lists. There's a paper about this. You just type in fun with type functions, you'll find a paper that shows how to do the same game with lists as the argument here. What's fun about that is that you don't statically know in advance how deep the list is. So in fact, you get a kind of infinite depth tree, but as for being a lazy language, makes that easy too. So that's okay as well. So I think this is really, really nice. This kind of very, very smoothly fits in with the world of type classes. It's a completely natural fit to say to have this extra level of a type function that goes with the value functions, and lets you do things that you really just couldn't do at all before. Let's see. I don't think I'm going to talk about list. Now, some then it also bottoms out nicely. Like, if you've got int, and you want to say, well, ints are a key for a map, and I've got some super efficient maps that just work on ints, well, that's fine, right? I can make map int on element be int map of, and then you can take your super efficient map representation and use that for these ints. So that's good, because it means that in our index map, the pair stuff and the list stuff, that's going to work using our structures, but as soon as we bottom out to a particular type like int, we can use some other kind of super efficient library at the leaves of our own tree. That's really nice, so we don't have to give up on his efficient library, we just use him at the bottom. So, does this make sense? This sort of type level functions and a type whose representation varies with the index type. I want to show you another example now. This is beta parallel Haskell example for why these kind of type level functions have turned out to be very helpful. Indeed, this example was the motivating example that forced us to put type level programming into GAC in the first place. We wanted to write data parallel programs. Now, in data parallel Haskell, our notation is that square brackets colon means vector of, but data parallel vector of. This is a vector of doubles, and here's a vector of pairs. Now, with these kind of things, if you're trying to do fast computation, it's no good having a vector of pointers to boxed doubles, right? And here, a vector of pointers to boxed pairs means that you're trying to do your GPU program and the GPUs are sort of running around chasing pointers all that, and that doesn't work at all, right? You've got to really be working on contiguously allocated data structures. So what are we going to do? What we'd like is to have the representation of the array vary with the element type. So very similar to the try that we saw before, plus LM array, so this parallel array thing is the type that's going to vary with the element. And I'll just show you indexing. So indexing takes an array of A's and an int and gives an A. All this is in a class. So now what about doubles? Well, doubles, so how do we make double an instance of LM? Well, we have to say how the type vector of double is implemented, and we have to implement index. How is vector of double implemented? Answer, it's implemented by a byte array, that is by a solid array of unboxed doubles. Now, this double guy in Haskell is a box thing. So indexing an array of doubles means to fetch out the appropriate byte by, you know, honest to goodness memory fetch indexing like in C, fetch it out from this C-like byte array. And then we have to return it as a double. So we do have to box it here. And I haven't written the code to do this. but it's not very hard, and within that, the consumer will then immediately unbox it, and the intermediate boxing will go away. But the point here is that the array itself is represented efficiently, right? Represented as box stuff. But look at the way that an array of pairs is represented. We want to represent, if you talk to four-track programmers, you'll find they represent an array of pairs by a pair of arrays, right? All the A's and all the B's, yeah? So, we would like to say an array of pairs of A and B's is represented by a pair of, that's its AP constructor, of an array of A's and an array of B's. And to index one of these guys, indexing means, remember, take an array of the things and an int and fetch out the value. Take an array, well, an array of the things, since it's a pair, it's going to be one of these AP guys. And these are the A's and these are the B's. Index them separately and pair together their results, and there you are. Nobody can tell from the outside that this array of pairs was implemented as a pair of arrays. All that's hidden behind indexing. You see what I mean? So it's kind of cool the way that the array representation just changes underneath. Now, it turns out that when you do, in data parallel Haskell, it uses a transformation called vectorization. And vectorization, more you could imagine as translating your data parallel program into one that works over these vectors as if you had vector instructions like vector add and vector multiply. If you were on a cray, you would have vector add and vector multiply. And some of these operations then become very efficient, like vector first. So first is the function that takes a pair and returns its first component. So first has the type A, B, arrow A. First up arrow has the type array of A, B, arrow array of A. And it's amazingly efficient, right? It doesn't run down this array, fetching all the head elements and constructing a new array. It simply picks out the A's. Right? Simple. And it turns out that having this work in constant time has a big effect on making data parallel Haskell vectorization transformation work smoothly. So much for pairs. Now what about arrays of arrays? Ha! Now, this is what an array of arrays looks like. So I really need a vector of vectors. So this is really important when you're doing sparse vector programming. You have something like this, you get a vector with vectors all of different lengths. And now you're in a bit of trouble with parallelism, because if you want to do data parallel operations over this, you're a bit in a bind about whether you say, let's go data parallel over the top level, and then sort of sequential over the rest, or do we go sequentially over the top and data parallel over the bottom ones? Right? Because it's difficult to get the workloads balanced. What you would like to do is this. If you take all those arrays here, and you rotate them sideways and put them end-to-end in a big, single, flat array, and then you have some kind of segment descriptor that says where the beginning of each of the sub-arrays is. Now you may imagine dividing up all of this data equally across the processors. So now each processor has the same amount of data. Right? Now you might sensibly be able to say, alright, you know, go to town, do your work on your chunk of data. But you may imagine there's a fair amount of bookkeeping, keep track of, you know, who's got which bits of which arrays. And automating that bookkeeping is what data parallel Haskell is about. So here is the way the data parallel Haskell represents these arrays of arrays. Let's see. Remember, we want to represent them flat. So here is, we say, array of A's, arrays of A's can be an element of an array. That's what I wanted to say. Right? If A can be an element of an array, one of those kind of declarations. So now we have to say, just like when we said over here, we needed to give a data type declaration that said how arrays of pairs is represented. Here we need to give a data type declaration that says how an array of arrays is represented. How are we going to represent it? As the data all concatenated end to end, plus this little guy here, the segment descriptor that says where each of them begins, which itself is another parallel array, right? Another vector. So it's a vector begins of start points and then a vector of the actual data all end to end. Now, here's an interesting operation. Concatenate takes all the takes an array of arrays and concatenates all the inner arrays together to make one big one. Well, concatenate is really efficient. It's another of these constant time operations. Look, right? Because this guy already is all the data concatenated together, so that was quick. Segmenting is another one that is often very useful, where you say, I've got one array, and I'd like to, and a big array, perhaps of a different type, that is sort of all the data, the same amount of data as in this guy, but different data. This tends to happen when you've taken the payload of this guy, you've taken an array of A's, and you've done something to all of his elements, to the data in, and then you want to reconstruct a sort of nested shape. So you want to take the shape from the first argument and the data from the second argument. So these operations turn out to be constant time too. So it just turns out that this representation allows the key operations for working in data parallel over these sparse vectors to work out in constant time. Of course, the real work is still isn't constant time, but it means that the bookkeeping overhead can be very fast, and that's really good. So it turns out these type functions are really, really helpful in, or this index data type is really, really helpful in building data parallel Haskell. One last example, and then we'll pack it in. I think this is a completely different example, also just showing you how type functions can make your life more exciting. Imagine you're writing some kind of client-server interaction, and you want to describe some protocol. Right, so we want to describe a process. So let's say add server. This is this guy over here. Add server is going to be some kind of process, and its type tells you its protocol. That is to say, let's say that every client and server has an input port and an output port. So what this says is, I receive an int, I receive another int, and then I spit out an int, and then I'm done. That's the way to read its type. Right. So the type describes the protocol that this server executes, and the client here spits out an int and spits out another int and then receives an int and then he finishes. So if we glue these two together with run, so run is supposed to take a client and a server and stitch them together, but he should only stitch them together if they have sort of complementary types. If there's, you know, this in corresponds to this out, this in corresponds to that out, this in corresponds to that out, and then the ends line up. Right? So I'd like run of add server and add client to be okay, but run of add server and add server to be not okay, because the server, if you stuck it together with itself, it would just deadlock. Right? So somehow the type of run is supposed to express this connection. So here's the simplest way I could give to make this completely concrete. So now I'm not just saying this type is kind of indication of its protocol. I'm giving you the implementation of the type. So in is a type with two parameters. Here it is. In takes this int and this second parameter. So here it is. In vp is a function from v to p's. Right. So take in a value and becomes a value of type p, which in this case is something that takes in another in. Right? Out, on the other hand, oh, this in just wraps up the thing. Out, on the other hand, that spits out a value and then becomes this process. Well, it's just a pair of the value and the process. And end is just end. So now, now I can write add server. So add server, here's the definitions again, has type init, so if it's anything of type init, it must be built with the in constructor, there it is, and then it must have a function from a value, so here's lambda x, that's of type v, so it takes in a value and produces a p, which is one of these guys, so he must be another in with another lambda y, and then he's supposed to be an out, isn't he? Yes, an out. What's an out? Oh, he's a pair of a value, the x plus y, and what, end? Well, there's only one end, and that's it. So there you are, that's an implementation of add server. This is the simplest way to instantiate this kind of type. It's just ordinary Haskell, no type functions yet. So the other one is simpler, the client is simpler. But the interesting thing is run. What is run supposed to do? It's supposed to take two types and connect them together in a way that makes sure that they rejects bad ones and accepts good ones. So what we want to do is to say that key is a process if run can connect keys and co-keys. Co-key is a sort of complementary process. So co is a type function that takes one of these types, like int, and produces its complementary one, out int, in int, end. Right? So that's what co is going to do, big problem, co here. It's just going to flip all the ins and outs. And run takes a process and its dual, its co, and connects them together. So, and the code is almost trivial, you know, sort of, we've done all the work now. We can see the co of in is out with a recursive call to co, and co of out is in with a recursive call to co, and the run works. There's only one way, this is one of these programs where once you've written the types, there's only one way you can write the code to make it work at all. But the point I wanted to get was, that the type of run is rather nice here, right? It says, I'll take any process P and its dual process, and it will connect them together in such a way that they're forced to speak the right language to each other. That's always good. This is a bit like contracts for processes. They're limited in expressiveness. But it works very nicely in this example. Okay? So, that's about it. I think I'm not going to talk about printf because it would take a bit longer, and I feel like my voice is beginning to run out. So, in fact, I think we'll probably just stop with pointing to the paper. So, the paper is a tutorial-style paper. So it has no figures with complicated syntaxes. It just has lots of examples, including all the ones that we've seen, and a few others. Something to do with machine address computation and tracking state. So keeping track of, is the file open, right, at the moment that you close it, it should be open, so you keep track of things like that. And a bit of stuff about tab-level computation. So it's really quite a few examples in this paper, but if any of this is intriguing, this is a good place to look. And I'm not going to talk about that, I should just stop here. It all is implemented in GOT and has been for some time. So worth giving it a whirl. For me, this has been this whole business about taking type classes and now adding a bit of computation into the type system. Now, once you start to be able to do these kind of computations in the type system and begin to move along that axis, right, that moves you more towards being able to state stronger properties about your programs. This run here that we had, where did run go? Oh, I've lost it now. That run was, it rejected some bad programs. It rejected some programs the way you had an ill-formed protocol. That's good, so I'm including bad programs, I'm outlining more good ones. So my real goal here is to set things up so that when you get comfortable with one level of type, you can sort of go on and express richer properties, all the while maintaining the joyful things that you've got, namely that it's checked every time and you've got a lot of time inference. But moving gently in the direction of a full structured dependency type language, which is sort of at the far end of the rainbow, but at least today requires a PhD to operate. We'll sort of move gently in that direction, sort of get as much goodness as we can without making pay it too high a price. Sooner or later, we're going to hit that. We're going to kind of pick all the low-hanging fruit, right? Sooner or later, we're going to get the point. There's none left, but so far we've had quite a lot more. There's quite a lot more to come. So, any other questions or observations? Have you done any of this kind of stuff in your program? The sort of 12th and clock guys, you probably do it all the time, right? So we're just think of this as playing catch up at the programming language level, right? So it's yeah.
So is the reason you're not just adding all the features of Kafka at once to get because you want to have efficient compilation, or is perhaps
well, not adding well. So so efficient compilation is a given. Like we've got to be able to do type erasure and full-on compilation of the machine code and so forth. So I want to maintain that property throughout. And Kog is not all that easy a language to program in. So you probably got used to it enough now that you think it is. But I still don't. So I don't know a way to add everything at once and still have a tractable programming language. Actor is closer, right? So Actor is always moving in the other direction, saying it's a fully full spectrum dependency type programming language, but it's still its execution model is still not great. It's a character pass untyped Haskell. That's another constraint that I'm deliberately placing myself under, which is that all of this stuff compiles into a very small but strongly typed intermediate language that's then compiled and phase typed, and then we do type erasure on that. And that's a sort of sanity check for doing something sensible. I don't know how to give you a completely satisfactory answer, except to say that I don't think anybody really knows how to just take Coq and get all the goodness of Haskell and all the goodness of Coq in one place at once. Whereas we're trying to go in that direction, but one step at a time.
So can you explain what Coq
is? What is Coq?
Yes.
Coq is a it's a proof assistant, really. So it's a language in which you do, it's how you think of it. It's a language in which you can conduct machine-assisted proofs. So if you want to prove the four-color map theorem, you know that theorem that says you can color... So that was there was a celebrated moment in which George Gonfier, who's my colleague in the next door office to me, he used Coq, finally, to prove the four-color map theorem. When I say prove and emphasize it, what that means is that although Coq is a big mass of code, in the end, everything it does compiles this very small language that they're very confident is sound, right? So there's this big amount of stuff that lets you generate these little programs, and the little core, the trusted code base is remarkably small. So they're very confident about that. So if you say you proved something in Coq, pretty much you proved it. Now, that required an enormous amount of creativity. You know, he didn't just type in the four-color map theorem and say, compile, you know, GHC-C four-color map theorem, right? Because coming up with a four-color map theorem is a very creative thing to do, right? He spent 3 years writing the proof. But writing the proof amounts to the kind of thing that type checkers do, right? That, if you like. If you're programming in Coq, you're essentially writing proofs, and Coq has elaborate facilities for writing some proofs automatically to automate a large portion of the proof generation process. In effect, type systems are working from the other direction. Rather than starting from a completely manual system and automating the obvious bits, we start from a completely automated system and see how sexy can we make it without giving up on the automation. So we're kind of, you know, creeping together. I have no idea how big this space in the middle is. We sort of nibble away. Nobody really knows when we'll meet up or whatever.
You're working at the type class. How often do you run into the type of
system? As in never, as in there's a spec that says when it should succeed. And of course, there's the odd bug. But pretty much, if type inference fails, it's because the program really isn't typed correct. And it tells you why. So it says, you know, I can't deduce that f of a is equal to f of b, for example, when there are no other constraints. And you might think, well, if you said that a was equal to b, then you'd be able to prove that. But there was no other reason to suppose that a was equal to b. And indeed, maybe f of it and f of bool could both be the same thing. So, it comes up with a sentence, I couldn't prove this from these premises, and you look at it and you say, that's not true. There's no way to prove that, that's just not true. That's like saying, I can't prove that it equals bool, that's a type error. The most troublesome case that happens is when you find that it says, I was expecting the function to have type for all a, f of a, arrow, f of a, and I inferred that it had type for all b, f of b, arrow, f of b, that looks kind of similar, right? So, and then it says, but I can't prove that f of a is equal to f of b because the function might not be injective. That's kind of annoying, but once you understand that that's a constraint on what the type system is able to prove and is what's supposed to be able to prove, then you add some annotations. So that's the most, but otherwise, no, you don't tend to end up with, what you don't end up with is an enormous armful of stuff through, unless you're writing a very complicated program, I suppose, that you have no clue what's going on. So it seems to work pretty well in practice. Give it a try, because it's what's quite good at, and what we work really hard at, is that if you know that f of g of x is equal to g of h of something else, where those are all type functions, so if those are the things you know, you may be able to deduce quite a lot from that. And that's so it's almost as if we run functions backwards. So there's, I'll tell you more. There's a paper called Modular Type Inference it's on my homepage, Modular Type Inference for something, and it describes the type inference mechanism for all of this. Their computational power. Well, they can be recursive, and one way of answering that, you might be asking that question as in, can the type checker diverge if you write silly type functions? Right. So if you say type f of x, if you said f of x equals f of x, would the type checker diverge? Yes, it would. So by default, you get some draconian rules that say if you obey all these rules, the type functions will not diverge. They're sort of, they're structurally recursive, right? And then, but you might want to relax those rules. Lots of useful programs do terminate, but don't satisfy those rules. And then you have to switch the rules off and say, trust me, I'm the programmer. If the type checker diverges, it's my fault. You could go better than that. Like AMDA has a termination checker built in, which is rather more sophisticated than these simple rules that GNC has. And we could do that as well, but at the moment, that hasn't seemed to be the primary difficulty that people encounter. That is, they leave the flag on usually. When they know what they're doing, they switch it off in the modules that declare the offending functions. And then if the type checker diverges, they find out pretty quickly. So in terms of user feedback, it hasn't been, you need a better termination checker. It's been, let me switch it off! Pretty much. In fact, if you switch the rules off, you can switch any recursive function at all. Yeah, if it's, I think it has to be structurally recursive. Meaning that you recursively invoke a function on something smaller than the argument. So if you say f of list of a is equal to a arrow f of a, for example, now recursively calling f on a smaller thing than that list of a argument, a smaller type. Yeah. The simple ones like that. I'm a bit hazy now you're asking me about exactly what the rules are, perhaps because this is the extent to which it's not really on the radar as being a serious problem, because the simple rules work fine for most people, and when they don't, the programmers know enough to say, for our term level programs, we don't expect the compiler to write to termination check. We're prepared to take responsibility for the termination of reverse, for example. And it's really the same with type level programs. It's just that the divergence happens today while the one time. Probably okay. Okay. I think we should wrap. I'd be very happy to chat with any more of you afterwards. It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you very much.